What Sean just been talking about is the great masculine renunciation was actually started in many ways by this man, Beau Brummell. And it coincided with the neoclassical moment of the late 18th century. The period of Brummell's influence coincided with the flowering of neoclassicism. His revolution in male attire extended to all aspects of clothing, cut, cloth, and color. Before Brummell, the ideal male proportions promulgated in art and fashion had been somewhat pear-shaped. Between 1650 and 1780, a gentleman's coat was cut to make the shoulders appear narrow and sloping, worn tight and open. It accentuated the stomach and emphasized the hips by falling open at that point on the body. It was also long, so making the legs appear rather short. Similarly, almost knee-length waistcoat and breeches that sat below the waist emphasized these proportions. The rather feminine appearance of this ensemble, from a modern point of view, though this ideal seemed anything but feminine at the time, was further accentuated by a curly wig and high-heeled buckled shoes. The materials used for these garments, which had been adopted from the French court, were usually velvet and silk, fabrics which, while appearing opulent, were hard to manipulate during tailoring and did not move with the body. The new interest in antiquity also led to a reappraisal of the physical ideal aspired by the ancient Greeks, as might be admired in the figures of the Parthenon frieze and the Apollo Belvedere. The system of clearly delineated limbs, heads and muscles, of harmonious stomachs and buttocks and breasts, this was perfected in antique nude sculpture, was adopted as the most authentic vision of the body, the real truth of natural autonomy, the Platonic form. It was not a question of advocating walking around naked or returning to the toga. Rather, it became the tailor's task to recreate this ideal in accordance with their skills and expertise and with the clothing already in existence. They offered the perfect classical body, aptly translated into the modern garments that were the most traditionally natural in themselves, the ones that even further suggested the unfallen Adam in the garden, the simple clothes of English country life. And this, what it actually looks like, the Apollo Belvedere looks like translated in the closing. Brummell refined the look of the country gentleman in a way that was so elegant and simultaneously functional that soon it became not only acceptable to dress in this manner in London, but positively de rigueur. His day clothes consisted of a navy morning coat, a buff waistcoat made of chamois leather, trousers and breeches made of buckskin, and soft hessian boots. In the evening he wore a black suit with a white waistcoat and tight trousers, buttoned on the instep and worn with pumps. The wadding and roping that had traditionally been used on court dress to give coat tails more weight now traveled upwards to give the impression of broad shoulders and chest. The coat tails were cut away to the back to show off the short waistcoat and the pantaloons, which were cut to sit above the waist. The skin-tight pantaloons, which continued to the instep, I haven't got the picture of the evening dress, but I'm going on about the evening dress, which continued the instep fastening around the foot with a strap, further helped to give the impression of long legs. But so that's just really the Brummell's revolution summed up. But there's also a dark side, which I'm going to concentrate on for the rest of the talk. And here it is. Here's the dark side. And it starts... It's prefigured in Brummell's life as it is in most dandies' life. And I'm just reading out the last bit of Brummell's life. You can familiarize yourself with most of Brummell's life elsewhere, I hope. The final decline started when he got his first job. Even if it was a sinecure. In order to help him to pay off his debts, the Duke of Wellington managed to have him appointed British consul in Cayenne. But the required repayments were vastly disproportionate to his salary, and his situation deteriorated rapidly, culminating in the abandonment of the consulate in Cayenne by the Crown. In 1835, at the instigation of his creditors, Brummell spent 2 months in debtor's prison. After his release, the remainder of his life was little more than a dance of death. He subsisted, despite the circumstances, on his favorite delicacy, the dainty and rather expensive biscuit Rose de Rheims, and his increasingly threadbare clothes were patched up for free by a sympathetic tailor. In 1840, the Beau had descended to a state of not only financial, but also mental anguish that was intolerable. Actually, Brummell had suffered episodes of depression throughout his life. According to his biographer, Ian Kelly, these blue devils, which is a blue devils, in their chronic later form were probably symptoms of syphilis. Eventually, Brummell was carried off to an asylum where he was soon to die, crying, "Loose me, scoundrels, I owe nothing." In the end, fate caught up with Brummell. Indeed, as Gilles Lepovetsky notes, the euphoria of fashion has its counterparts in dereliction, depression, and existential anguish. But the dandy integrates the saturnine side of his nature into his being without viewing it as a flaw in his existence. Melancholia, decline, and an early grave are the flowers of evil that he sports in his buttonhole. Indeed, the yearning for tragic fate is the only motivation of the dandy, as he is free of worldly ambition. In death, he realizes himself as his life, like a suit, becomes a unified whole. So now I'm going into a few of the... the decadent side of dandyism and the problems with dandyism and modernity. So firstly, there's an extremely negative narcissism, because the dandy, his extreme elegance is often not a straight vanity, but a thing where he sees himself as very ugly. And there's a quote by Michel Ries I want to read out, which illustrates that perfectly. "I prefer to dress with a maximum amount of elegance. Because of the physical faults I have mentioned, I generally think of myself as inelegant. I have a horror of suddenly catching my reflection in a mirror. As if I'm caught unawares, I seem to myself of a humiliating ugliness each time." And the next thing is about the dandy's position in modernity, as it was defined by Walter Benjamin. This is actually a slide from Playtime, but it shows very neatly man in relationship to modernity. There's a special constellation. This is actually Baudelaire, Benjamin paraphrasing Baudelaire. "There's a special constellation in which greatness and indolence meet in human beings. This constellation governed Baudelaire's life. He deciphered it and called it modernity. When he loses himself in the spectacle of the ships lying at anchor, he does so in order to derive a parable from them. The hero is as strong, as ingenious, as harmonious, and as well-built as those boats. But the high seas beckon to him in vain, for his life is under the sway of an ill star. Modernity turns out to be his doom. There are no provisions for him in it. It has no use for his type. It moors him fast in the secure harbor forever and abandons him to everlasting idleness. Here, in his last incarnation, the hero appears as dandy, a Hercules with no labors to accomplish." And given the dandy's nature as a work of art, the main problem he has as he is early finished in life is the passing of time. The passing of time poses particular problems for him. His life is only partially the natural progress from naivety to maturity. Having realized himself early, he faces eternity. He is conscious of the fact that he cannot do justice to the traditional modes of maturity, and they cannot do justice to him. Nor does he fit within conventional patterns of masculinity. Thus, the fully formed dandy has to develop strategies for coping with the passage of time, strategies that allow him to remain unchanged. And now I'm going into the strategies. And the most successful and most recommended strategy is suicide. This is from a film about suicide, actually. "The most radical solution to this problem is suicide. In his study of Baudelaire, Walter Benjamin identified suicide as a passion particulière de la vie moderne. The resistance modernity puts up against man's natural productive élan is disproportionate to his powers. It is understandable if he flags and flees into death. Hence, modernity must stand under the sign of suicide, an act which seals a heroic will that makes no concessions to a mentality inimical towards his will. Such a suicide is not renunciation, but heroic passion. It is the concept of modernity in the realm of the emotions." And here is Jacques Rigaud, one of the most famous dandy suicides, who early on in his 20s decided that one day he's going to commit suicide, and not as a out of despair, but as a work of art and as a confirmation of his dandyism. And he said, "I will be a great dead man. Try if you can stop a man who travels with suicide in his buttonhole." And this is the writer Pierre Dreux La Rochelle, who wrote the most famous suicide novel, Le Feu Follet, to whom suicide was also an idée fixe that he would eventually realize. Dreux La Rochelle immortalized his friend Rigaud in his great suicide novel, Le Feu Follet. His protagonist, Alain Leroy, is a dandy whose identity has led him into a cul-de-sac early in life. He removes his mask when he laments the first principle of the dandy, distance, to not touch and to be untouchable. I cannot touch, I cannot hold, and basically it comes from the heart. So there's a bit, but there are less extreme, you'd be pleased to hear, versions of overcoming time than suicide. One of them is illness. This is Oblomov, but he's not ill, but his illness, I suppose, was laziness. But but illness in its physical illness itself is also quite salutary to the dandy. A less final way than suicide of defying time is illness. In illness, the dandy can legitimately retreat from doing to a state of being. As the Hungarian writer Sándor Márai noted in 1947, modern scholars of the soul tend towards the assumption that humans only become ill when they want to flee the responsibilities of life. Is there a more beautiful journey than a bout of appendicitis when the poor man can have a holiday from life? Does not have to engage in the daily struggle for existence anymore and is gently rocked towards the miraculous shores of death? But that's physical illness, but mostly the dandy engages in mental illness, depression. And I will follow a few of my favorite depressive images. Otto Mann finds the true natures of the dandy in his pathology. In the convulsive desire for fulfilling content to life, all possibilities are exhausted. Barbidor Villis sought redemption and suffering as in the decadent manner. Yet man denies the dandy the desired release. As such a wretch never suffered a clearly delineated materiality, never found the sweet consolation of being the willing victim of circumstances beyond his control, his suffering remained the sad delight of tearing himself apart, which the end leaves nothing behind but a dissected, repugnant cadaver. The impotence and lack of dignity of this suffering, the shameless analysis, the reopening of self-inflicted wounds, the oscillation between emotionless torpor and violent agitation, in the end all were felt by the dandy himself. To the modern eye, what man describes, it's Otto Mann, it's an earlier man, no relation. Here is not so much reprehensible indulgence as the infinitely painful state of depression. The dandy's philosophical determined idleness, his complete self-absorption and his coolly analytical nature rather predispose him towards pathological melancholia. Precisely because of excessively rational nature, he is susceptible to escaping into the irrationality of mental illness, which in the case of the depression is not a helter-skelter of emotions, but their terrifying absence. Here are a few good-looking depressives. And Scott Walker. Now, the next, even less extreme form of escaping time is travel. There we have it. A certain more agreeable possibility for defying the unbearable passage of time is geographical flight, as embodied in travel. Leaving the familiar behind is more important here than arriving in the unknown, since upon arrival it is only a matter of time before its passage becomes unbearable again. So it is the departure, and as Edward Gibbon knew already, the journey itself that approached closest to a form of relief. I am always so much delighted and improved with the union of ease and motion that were, not the expense enormous, I would travel every year some 100 miles. The state of movement that the train journey entails, for example, allows the dandy to move with the times rather than watch time dwindle away. Sometimes there is not even the necessity for actual departure in order to gain the refreshing sensation of leaving the familiar. Chandor Marai recounted how in times of particular poverty, for which reason the dandy has frequently to deny himself the pleasure of travel, he would go to the railway station, inquire about the departure time for the Rome Express, and buy a platform ticket, sandwiches and magazines. He would then place his foot on the running board of the smoking carriage and his gloved hand on the brass door handle before hopping off again, at the very moment of departure and going on home refreshed. Indeed, the names of the various trains de luxe that still existed in the first half of the 20th century seemed designed for this kind of spiritual refreshment through daydreaming. The wish to travel, the desire for flight and obscurity is yet another utopia that nourishes the natural death wish of the dandy. Partir, c'est toujours mourir un peu. Therein lies its attraction. So then come the most popular form of fighting the passage of time. What reminds are the most immediate ways of escaping time labeled pleasures by Baudelaire, le paradis artificiel. Alcohol, fornication, and le paradis artificiel, excessive enjoyment of which equates most closely to the common definition of decadence. So I've got alcohol, as you can see. I've got drugs. I haven't got an image of fornication. I assume you know what it looks like. They lay at the heart of fin de siècle dandyism, the naughty 90s of the 19th century. The archetypes of the decadent dandy is again Usman's fictional Descent in Arebourg, the book which the cultural critic Mario Pras describes as the pivot around which the psychology of the whole decadent movement centers. We meet Des Esseintes at a point in his life when he is already greatly weakened by the excess of active decadence and has retreated into a self-created ermitage in the banlieue. He fights his ennui with virtual excesses such as the creation of symphonies of taste for the palate from exotic liqueurs and the study of ecclesiastical literature. The last of an aristocratic line that over the years has become increasingly anemic, the Des Esseintes is neurasthenically sensitive to everything and everybody. Like Wilde with Dorian Gray, whose Bible, the Yellow Book, is actually Arebourg, Usman conveys only a vague impression of exactly what pleasures have so sated Des Esseintes, does his cold steel blue eyes look on the world with universal disdain. Sexually, however, he distances from encounters with singers and actresses by evil mistresses and experienced in every art and ever less refined whores to unnatural love affairs and perverted pleasures, in inverted commas, the last two, obviously. The seemingly inevitable results of this polymorphous perversity are lethargy and impotence. The fin de siècle dandy replaces Brummel's asexuality with the celebration of sexual marginality and pathology. Where effeminacy was an adornment to the Regency dandy, and decadent, it becomes a weakness. So then we go into the characters of the book, which the first one is Adolf Loos. And Loos was not only a great Anglophile, but he was also greatly concerned with the modern nerves and closing relating to modern nerves. And I'm not going to go into great detail, but you see him here wearing tightly. He's basically talking about the lounge suit, which was, you know, as the name says, for relaxing. But he found actually the times in which he lived, which is the early 20th century, not yet in tune with the lounge suit. Sometimes people feel more comfortable when they're casually dressed, sometimes when they're smartly dressed. We are living in an age when people want to dress smartly, more buttoned up. Even our lounge suit, which by virtue of its visible waistcoat is designed to be worn open, was already worn increasingly buttoned before the war. Obviously, the nerves demanded. The more modern man's nerves are, the more buttoned his coat will be. Then there's his loose great friend Peter Altenburg, who was so nervous that he had a belt fitted to everything, even an evening suit. As an example, he cited his friend Peter Altenburg, who 15 years earlier and somewhat ahead of his time had belts fitted to all his coats so that he could pull them in more snugly at the waist. Altenburg was also a warning of the closeness of perfectionism to pathology. So modern were his nerves that he not only had a belt fitted to his dinner jacket, but also spent most of his life in psychiatric institutions. And then the next character is no, that's the Loos bar, which Adolf Loos was actually an architect mostly, as well as a writer about men's fashion. And it's a study in claustrophilia, which relates to the buttoned-up nature of the dandy and the buttoned-up nature of the modern nerves. It's the tiniest bar, and it's because the dandy sort of rules in a reduced space, because that's the sort of empire can oversee. And then now comes the Duke of Windsor, who was, despite what you might think, extremely unhappy. And Cecil Beaton said about him, "The Duke's face now begins to show the emptiness of life." This is at the end of the Duke's life. "He looks like a mad terrier, haunted one moment, then with a flick of the hand, he's laughing fecklessly." But there was something that made him happy. Presumed to allow for late rising, meals at the Duke's homes were put forward by an hour from the conventional times. Cocktail hour, the highlight of the Duke's day, came at 7, and it was clear to visitors that the drinking hour sometimes seemed to him a long time in coming. And he is happy after a few martinis. So I think I'm going to pass over Bunny Roger. This is the next character in my book with a new Edwardian Bunny Roger, but I don't think there's time to go into details. Richard Widmark, the bold look, which Bunny Roger replaced with the new Edwardian look, and he's a teddy boy, which who took the look of the new Edwardians and made it their own. Now we have Quentin, who had who regarded the alienation inherent in dandyism as a positive thing. This is again cultivating pathology and making it yourself. So in terms of which relates to the containment of the loose bar, Quentin Quist put forward onanism as an example of what is, after all, the dandy's real art, containment. "Masturbation is not only an expression of self-regard, it is also the natural emotional outlet of those who, before anything has reared its ugly head, have already accepted as inevitable the wide gulf between their real futures and the expectation of their fantasies." So the sexual alienation Quentin regarded as a positive thing, but and also his unhappiness, which was not only caused by his in reality receding hairline. So Quentin on unhappiness. "My failure to win true love, to stay in the movie industry, to write books that anyone would publish, were not a series of unconnected accidents to which I was prone because of my exposed position in society. They were the expression of my character, the built-in concomitant of a morbid nature to which dreams were more vivid than reality. The infinitesimally small success that I had known had been achieved inevitably in terms of being rather than doing. The essence," and then he finally got happy in America, "the essence of happiness is its absoluteness. It is automatically the state of being of those who live in the continuous presence all over their bodies. No effort is required to define or even attain happiness, but enormous concentration is needed to abandon everything else." So now we come to Jean-Pierre Melville, who is the penultimate character in my book, and he is more, obviously, his dandy is more expressed in his films. And in the book, I mostly discuss his last three films, which all star not him. This is Soleil Froid rather than Christeva's Soleil Noir. This is Alain Delon on the scaffold. Alain Delon's on-screen persona before Les Samurai, which is the first film he made with Melville, had been described as an homme fatale. As well as playing the male lead, he had also usurped the role generally played by the female lead, the object of desire, of aesthetic contemplation. Post-Melville, Delon becomes a philosophically and tragically enhanced amoralist. The minimalist modernity of his acting and his epicene features lent him a darkly angelic quality. The horror that lies within its fascination is the comforting horror of death that it brings to others as though it were a gift. So intensely does he desire it himself. Delon screened death, and it is hard to recall a Delon film of any significance that does not end in his death or the kind of glorious failure that is almost equivalent amongst the most celebrated rituals of nihilistic beauty to be found in the post-war cinema. Yeah, he's dead and beautiful. Have him here. The narcissistic persona that Melville projects in the Delon trilogy displays two mutually dependent characteristics. pathological nostalgia, and sexual abstinence. Freud describes the brief period of infantile self-sufficiency as a narcissistic phase. What the narcissist projects as his ideal is his substitution of the lost narcissism of his childhood, in which he has his own ideal, in which he was his own ideal. While the innate narcissism of every human can thus be taken as a given, the pathological narcissist fails to successfully transfer his desire onto a human object, but is more likely to attach it to objects from an idealized past. As fulfillment is located in the past, the narcissist's desire is necessarily thwarted, and the only domain in which he can comfortably identify himself is that of melancholia. The concomitant loss of libido allows him to appear wholly self-possessed or cool. But Narcissus is not completely without object. The object of Narcissus is psychic space. It is representation itself, fantasy. But he does not know it, and he dies. If he knew, he would be an intellectual, a creator of speculative fiction, an artist, writer, psychologist, or psychoanalyst. Art and artifice, the creation of a beautiful world as a successful sublimation of the depressive's death wish, was written about extensively by Freud and subsequently by Kristeva. The dandy invents nothing. It is reality that is rendered artificial. Abstract dreams inspired by memory unfold from a position that seems already to be impervious to time. The dandy has a past but no future. Despite its ephemeral and elusive nature, beauty assumes a supreme value in the melancholic's world. It is his other domain. While the dandy per se confirms himself within the tragic world of Narcissus when he employs his aesthetic memory in the cultivation of his own person, the writer dandy and by extension the director dandy are arguably in a privileged position as they can apply their ideals to the limitless realm of fiction. The latter even has the potential to fulfill the depressive's ultimate dream, the creation of a hermetic, artificial, and complete world in accordance with his own highly individual ideal of beauty, his specific tastes. The dandy's essential narcissism will, however, ensure that his world remains a melancholic one. The Delon-Melville collaborations abound with the motifs of melancholia, depicted by Melville in such a way that they might become the equivalent of Proust's temps perdu for... Oh, shit. okay. The equivalent of Proust's temps perdu for subsequent generations of melancholics. Unconsummated sexuality, interiors of shabby austerity, and permanently dark or rain-lashed exteriors. Walter Benjamin wrote of a rainy day in Paris, the kind that Melville professed to love. Urban rain with a sly lure to dream itself back into the days of early childhood can only be fathomed by the child of the metropolis. Rain masks more everywhere, turns the days not only gray but homogeneous. From morning to evening, one can do the same, play chess, read, while sun shadows the hours quite differently and doesn't bode well for the dreamer. Hence, he has to lead the bright days with guile. So I'm now going to, obviously, I said only 5 minutes, going to go a bit quicker. So. 10? 2? Oh, my Jesus. Okay, this is... this is Le Samurai. These are photos of Le Heure Bleu, which is a particularly, so for the depressive, it's the most beautiful hour of the day, when dreams sort of reality merges into dreamscape, and you have a few Bleu photos. This is then Fassbinder, who I dedicate the last chapter to, and there's a quite a juicy neurosis there, which I won't be able to tell you about. I mean, his dandy was one of ugliness. He wanted to be, he cultivated his, rather than his beauty, wanted to cultivate his ugliness. So, and his main theme was angst. And so it's to the point that he fetishized tranquilizers and Valium, which you can see in the symphony here. This is for Despair, was I going to talk about in more detail. This is about the woman's suit. The suit of the 1970s on a woman and on a man that thought of himself as a woman, which looks slightly different. And so I'm just going to finish up with the last bit, if I find it, which is, Jesus... The little bit of hope that comes at the end of the dandy's life. What remains of the dandy? Has all the good gone from the word goodbye? Baudelaire begs every human who thinks to show me what begs of every human who thinks to show me what remains of life. And dandyism appears to be a form of life that is all but dead. For an enlightened resurrection, we might turn again to Proust, whose concept of regaining time was described by Camus in terms of an alternative to religion. It has been said that the world of Proust was a world without God. If that is true, it is not because God is never spoken of, but because the ambition of this world is also to be is absolute perfection and to give to eternity the aspect of man. Time Regained, at least in its aspiration, Time Regained is the last book in the research. Time Regained, at least in its aspiration, is eternity without God. While the modernist Proust tried to regain the spirit of the Belle Epoque of his childhood, today's bourgeois rêveur seeks to recapture the consciousness of modernity itself. Actively decadent, he uses the disillusioning experience of the last three decades to come to a considered notion of taste. Aware that good taste and fashion are both constructs, he looks to his own past, his own moments of pain, and inspiration to arrive at an intelligent notion of taste. Intelligent taste in the Proustian sense is analytical intelligence mutated to a poetic sensorium. In a world that has lost its grip on meaning, the dandy understands that taste is not an arbitrary collection of likes and dislikes, but rather the form of intelligence. An intelligence that transcends the ubiquitous knowledge of styles, past and present. Gaining this intelligence is a perpetual process which is part and parcel of the gaining of self-knowledge. But to have gained it, cela justifie une vie. Okay. That's it.
Thank you. Okay, don't run away. Okay, so we're going to take about 5 minutes of the coffee break to have some questions for Sean and Philip. So, Sean, I'm back now. So we'll take some questions, please. So we've got one question over there. Okay. Oh. Maybe she could just... Oh. Sorry, thank you.
Oh. Good. Okay, so you've outlined the psychological profile of the dandy as someone who's quite neurotic. What do you think are like the modern day implications for the modern day dandy and how menswear is marketed to men who love a flourish, who like dressing up?
I didn't understand the last bit.
What are the implications for the modern day dandy and how menswear brands are marketed and positioned? Do you think there's a bit of a disconnect and a lack of understanding between the psychology? And
according to my theory, apart from the last bit, which is a purely cerebral kind of dandy, the dandy dies with modernism. So the last bit of modernism, I would say, is about 1983. So today there can be no dandies.
Well, men who love a bit of flourish, that's what I'm reinterpreting in that. And
but that's dandyism, like everything else, has just become a form of fashion. So it's not, you know, the endless people with interesting facial hair and tight trousers are not dandies to me.
Do you think there's any modern-day implications for menswear? Do you think, from all of your body of work, there are any modern-day implications then?
Well, Sebastian Bosley was a modern dandy because he definitely had the... His dandyism was OCD, so he was expressed himself in OCD, so he was so obsessively compulsive, that which is very dandyistic, the perfectionism of having everything, you know, extremely tidy and stuff. He's the last sort of successful dandy I can really think of in the public eye. Does that satisfy you? No, obviously not.
But also, it's a conveniently misused term for selling a certain style to men, isn't it? It's a really overused, misused.
Dandyism. I mean, there's a wonderful essay about dandyism and fashion about Roland Barthes. I mean, dandyism had to go when men's fashion started, basically, because dandyism is the opposite of men's fashion. And as soon as boutiques and things like that for men were deduced, dandyism was made obsolete because fashion. In terms of dandyism, is a paradox because you can't sell individuality. I mean, fashion designers think they can sell individuality, but it's impossible. And dandyism is all about individuality.
No, I understand. In the truest sense of the word, of course, it may be dead. But I mean, if you go to Piti Uomo, a lot of men would identify with being called a modern day dandy, whether it's true or not. And I just thought, was wondering if there was any implications between the psychological profile of men who do love to dress up, who do love individuality in their style, and how menswear is marketed today.
Whether they are neurotic. The more the better. The more neurotic they are, the more successful they'll be as dandies. Mm-hmm.
Do we have any more questions? Okay, everyone's dying for a coffee. Okay, so please come back in 25 minutes, and we'll start the final session for today. Thank you.